So, Sylvia, you have these observations, your first-person observations in Nigeria. You have your sense of history and the witch burnings. And then what do you think of right now as far as the combination between austerity, privatization, debt in the realm of education? Because I know you've spoken about how education brings together this long-standing trajectory of austerity, privatization, debt. Could you explain that more?
Yes, very much. In fact, we saw that. In fact, I've been a teacher all of my life, and of course I've been profoundly interested in the question of education from the time I was a student. I was in the student movement in my youth, and then I became a teacher. So, but it was really when I was doing this contract teaching in Nigeria that I became more interested and involved in the struggle around education, because one of the things that was slashed most dramatically was precisely the education budget. And we began to see a whole process, not only the suffering of students and the suffering of teacher and the whole repression that in the case brought many, many students to jail and also many students killed, but also the fact that in order to survive, many departments and university began more and more commercialized. So we actually saw there in the 80s, you know, some of the processes that later in the 90s I saw in the United States. And in fact, when I returned to the United States, myself with other African colleagues, we set up this organization called the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa, where we said the first freedom is the right to education. But this is what, in fact, has taken place, which is whereas in the 50s and 60s, there was at least a recognition that education had a social benefit, and a benefit also for, and primarily for the work of labor, for the employer class, in the sense that education produced better workers, more productive workers and better citizens. With the inception of neoliberalism, that idea has been completely dismissed. And now we are told that education is a private interest, that whatever funding we put into our education, that funding has to come from us because we are the only beneficiary. There is a way in which they want to deny the fact that schooling has a social impact, as a social, and to present the student as something of a small capitalist who has to invest in himself or herself and is solely responsible, right, for his education and the sole beneficiary of the advantages that will come from it. So there is the ideology that has developed together, hand in hand with the cuts in public education, which is very, very pernicious because continuously masks the relation of exploitation that is involved and, in a sense, makes of that the fundamental means, the fundamental relation and means of exploitation, because now the student is not any longer a future worker or a worker in the process of being trained, but now become a little capitalist who has made an investment, and that investment has failed or is in question. And now the student is a debtor, has a one-to-one relationship to the bank, and that relationship, you know, in a sense, will shape also his future life, because very few students now can actually repay their loan, because the conditionalities that have been attached to them also makes it extremely difficult, you know, for students to pay back. You know, because, for instance, if you cannot pay an installment, and now, for instance, students, after they graduate, they cannot find immediately a job. But if you cannot pay, then the interest rate goes up, and then a debt that seemed manageable. You know, what you see is very interesting. You see a parallel with what happened with third world countries who took a loan from the World Bank and the IMF. And then with the change of the interest rates, right, those third world countries, that they thought could be manageable. But they didn't control the monetary system. And so they found themselves all of a sudden towards in front of a debt that had tripled. Same with students. You miss one payment or two payments, and then the fine print you may have not read. And that I know people have gone underground. People have gone abroad because they couldn't continuously live with the telephone calls from the collection agency. It was now call your nan, they call your mother, they call your father, they call your fiancé, they call the people that you know. And it's really a racket. And it's a disgrace because education should not be something that is bought and sold. And in fact, there is now a movement against the debt that has taken off over the last year and is now spreading across the country. And that movement is very important because makes that as a key issue, the fact that the debt is illegitimate. Because education should not be something that is bought and sold. And in fact, those who are engaging in that movement, they make a petition which says, when another million of students like me will join, we together will refuse to pay the debt. And that petition is also open to teachers and to the parents because both are involved. If a parent has co-signed the loan, in many cases they even take off their social security. And many parents have been impoverished because they signed the loan together with their children. As for teacher, I'm a teacher. I don't want to teach students who are going to become servants to the bank. How can I go to, a serious face to speak in a class and teach these great ideas when I know that my students' life is going to be ruined in the process of trying to pay for these classes that I'm giving to them. I don't want to be an accomplice to that. And I'm very happy that this movement is now making a space also for teachers who want to teach, who want to really be engaged in a really serious dialogue with their students and not prepare people to become indentured servants to the banks.
So students, parents, teachers all unifying in a sort of a debt strike. Is there an actual campaign? You're in New York. Are people doing this? Could you just tell us like how this is really being organized?
Yeah, there's been a long discussion across the country. Because the issue, in fact, has even entered, to some extent, the electoral campaign. Over the last year, even the two presidential candidates have had to say certain things, although they have not really dealt with it in any way they could conceive as being constructive. But the issue of student debt is not so humongous. On April 25 of this year, it reached $1 trillion. Imagine $1 trillion. Right? In fact, there was a demonstration in New York to mark this event. So there had been other organizations for over the last few years. And some, for example, are demanding the right to bankruptcy because you cannot bankrupt from a student loan. Another organization is telling the government, look, if you raise this loan, you are going to boost the economy, because a lot more young people will have more money in their pocket. But what this new organization that really took off in the fall out of the Occupy movement gave it an impulse, is an occupation that in a sense is moving towards a strike. And by strike saying, really, this is a debt that has no legitimacy. It's a debt that should not be paid because it comes out of a policy that does not have a justification. It's a policy that basically says you can buy and sell ideas. You can buy and sell education. And this, in fact, is an illegitimate policy. And in that sense, students have been forced to take it. And it's really so true. We are told now, you know, if you are a student, you're told you have no future if you don't have an education. You will have a miserable life, you know, for the kind of economy that we have. It's a knowledge-based economy. You have to. But then the government doesn't take any responsibility. So, and not only that, the cost of going to school has escalated way, way beyond the kind of increase in the cost of living. At least it's escalated 7 times faster than the cost of living has increased. So there's really something fraudulent happening here. You know, the students are being asked to do something that is really impossible. And in addition, education should not be a commodity, something that you put on the counter as if it was a toothpaste. I think toothpaste too should also be free. But the idea that you can put a price tag also on idea is especially objectionable. And this is what I think this movement is discussing and is organizing on the basis of this. Not only on the basis of an economic issue, but also the basis of a social issue. Asking the country, is this really what you want? Do you really want a world in which even education is something that you have to pay for? So a world where everything now has to be bought and sold. Where are we going to end? Where is this going to end? Are we going to put a price on conversation? Am I going to make you pay when I have an idea, or you make me pay when we exchange an idea? Are ideas and theories collective as well? Isn't language a collective creation? Where do we draw the line?
So we're kind of wanting to regroup. That was great. We're running each other little notes about, you know, now that we're just aware of your time. I'm just making sure, Marcy, you have what you need as far as a lot of the... we didn't really compare with the witch burning and the rupture. I call it the rupture. They call it the transition from feudalism to capitalism, but I've been playfully with Marcy calling it the rupture, not to romanticize. But is there something more you need either in the history piece or the wages for housework piece? Although I just started a new campaign, by the way. It's called Wages for Being a Student. The same way they develop. You like that?
We actually had.
So we're co-creating here now, and I just want to toss it to Marcy. Wherever you want to take it, there's a lot that yeah.
Yeah, I can't resist. This was not on our list, but what came to me as you were talking about education debt, I was thinking in general about the level of credit card debt that is burdening the working class, because the employer class has been increasingly unwilling to negotiate terms and conditions which will let people survive. So perhaps there should be a whole movement against the credit card
debt. There is. Actually, what is being taking place in New York is that the movement that began as a movement of students against the debt, that is still on, but has become part also of a broader coalition, of a broader movement that now is struggling against debt in principle. You know, debt as a disciplinary instrument that is now being used in more and more areas. For example, credit cards, you know, housing, right? So more and more debt is, I think, is a very interesting development. The fact that over the last 20 years, you know, and more actually the last 3 decades, we see more and more debt becoming the tool, you know, through which people are being exploited, and the tool through which the capitalist class accumulates wealth, right? And so in that way, there is a broad front. And I think there is a reason, because when you are exploiting a person as a debtor rather than as a worker, then you have a very different type of relation. You know, the work involved becomes invisible. The exploitation relation involved becomes invisible,
and as it has with women.
And what you begin to see, there is this notion that, you know, you are, again, the little capitalist, self-investment, but the whole question of what is taken away from you, right? The blame is put on you. In other words, you become the responsible. You don't see any longer that there is a class of employer who is actually benefiting from the work that you do and you the extra work that you have to do because of the debt, right? All that is seen is that somehow you failed and somehow you have a moral responsibility. And so that relation of exploitation becomes very individualized, becomes very mystified and very individualized. And it becomes much more difficult to organize around it. You know, we saw, for example, over and over, students were feeling very guilty, often didn't want to talk about the debt they had because they were feeling it was their fault, that they let the thing slide and somehow the debt grew. Even if it was the case that the way the conditions were written really pushed them in that direction. But they were feeling a tremendous guilt and didn't want to talk about it. And I think that this shift, you know, from worker to debtor, it's a very, very important transformation in the form of social relation through which, you know, exploitation is organized, that we have to really think through and, you know, challenge ideologically as well as also practically organizing and saying, no, this debt have been accrued illegitimately. And you're absolutely right. The credit card is because many people could not survive. You cut wages, you cut services. What do you expect people to do? To quietly resign and go on a sidewalk and die? You know, people have taken to use credit cards because wages have been cut. You know, employment has been cut. It's more and more difficult to have a job. More and more difficult to make a wage that is a living wage. Housing has escalated, the cost of housing. The cost of everything else has escalated. And then people have to use credit card. And then, you know, you're hooked, right? So there's something very, very pernicious. And, you know, it's very important that all those who are in that situation, in a sense, connect. Because it's a common struggle.